Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome, everybody, to your very favorite podcast, Life's a Banquet, a show about all things edible, spreadable, and pourable with me, your host, Clifford the Big Red Dog, and
me, I don't know.
Nicole.
Oliver from Oliver and Company.
Oh, that's good. That's also an animal. That's cute.
Yes, it is.
Sorry, there are some Italian men having an argument outside of my window, and it's a very loud. They're like, fuck you, move your fucking car. And then I was like, that was me last week.
Yeah, that was when you beat up a Hasidic Jew.
We had a cage match. It was real rough. I said, well, come
on. I got
here
to be there for it, which was pretty great on the phone.
What's happening with you? What's going on?
Nothing's happening. I'm hanging out in my house, which looks really good because I now have a dining room table and a chair. I don't really like the chair, but
what's wrong with the chair?
It's just my parents gave it to me and it's like old and wicker and brown.
The wicker man chair. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I had to buy like a pillow to sit in the seat of it and fucking pillows. Pillows are, I'm not even done telling this story yet. This isn't even the bad part.
Well, you had me at pillow. I mean, is there a greater threat to American life than the pillow?
Well, this pillow at fucking Target cost $30. And I was on the
senseless
phone with my sister and she was like, yeah, pillows are investment pieces. And I was like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm. It's very, very questionable. I don't understand why pillows are so expensive. There's many things that I don't understand, like the cost of, to be honest, I'm not sure why a fucking chair is so expensive. Chairs are so, and I understand, yes, you sit in them, they support you. You can sit in one for years and years. I get it. But like every chair has to be over $500. I mean,
I know.
Give me a break.
And like what, if a chair is $500, how much is a couch supposed to cost then? Because that's just not right. It's more than like three chairs put together. It should be like $3 million.
Absolutely. Don't even get me started on Cambro containers. That's a little inside baseball for our restaurant
never
listeners. Do you know what a Cambro container is? I just would like a quick pause. A Cambro container, folks, if you're not sure what it is, it's basically like a restaurant quality Tupperware where you put stuff in. Do you know that like a 4-quart Cambro container is like $30? And it doesn't even come with the fucking lid. You have to buy the lid separately.
What? They're $30?
Yes, I'm telling you, they're so expensive.
Oh my God, I'm going to start stealing them from my work.
You should sell them on the black market. Sell them to me.
I'll sell them. I'll be like, I'll trade you this fucking Cambro for a pillow. They're the same price. Why?
It's the new, like, selling cigarettes, $10 cigarettes at the bodega. It's like $10 yes. Cambros.
Don't tell people about that, Sarah.
That's true. All right. So anyway, what else happened in this pillow fiasco? Is that it?
That's all. Then this is actually a good story because I managed to go to Target and only buy the two things that I needed, which were tank tops and pillows. And I did not diverge and I did not accidentally spend $300 there, which what Target wants you to do every time you walk in the door.
It does. Whenever I go to any store, like particularly like this happens to me at Michael's, I then become convinced that I'm going to be a new person who like needs like a live, laugh, love sign. And like now I'm going to decorate everything with fake flowers and I'm going to get into making like miniatures and stuff. And I'm just like overwhelmed by the possibilities of who I could be. So that's why I try to stay out of Michael's.
Well,
or Target.
Target, yeah. I mean, they're designed to trick you into spending more. I would have spent more money there because I was going to buy some like holiday decorations for my home, but they were like completely wiped out of everything that was Christmas related, except for one
really
white light up tree, which I was like, this tree is pretty cute. I want to get it. And then it told me that it was $100. And I was like, no, it's more expensive wow than a real Christmas tree.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I had a Christmas tree incident as well over the weekend, and I had contemplated going for a phony tree, which has never been my style. However, I like a phony tree, especially if it's like a fun color, like pink or white.
Yeah.
But I've never done it before, and they are expensive, but real trees are expensive, and you're cutting down a freaking tree, and then you just buy the tree, the fake tree once. You know what I mean? It lasts a lifetime. Now, that's something that's worth investing money in. Sure, you only use it for 2 weeks a year, but it's like, you don't sit in it. You could make it into a chair if you really wanted to, I guess.
Where would you even store a Christmas tree, though?
I have plenty of storage. I've got my overhead storage above my bathroom. I've got a basement I could put that dusty old tree in.
Well, I saw an aluminum Christmas tree at the thrift store. Well, not the thrift store. It was like the antique
aluminum
store. Yeah, because that's what they were made out of in the olden days. But it's just like tinsel, you know?
Oh, I love a vintage tinsel tree. That's very nice.
But it was $165.
It's a dream. You should have brought it and just left it up all year. That's
cute. I
guess
I should have. Yeah, that's a good idea. But instead, I bought one of those little ceramic light-up Christmas trees that are vintage. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Those are fabulous. I'm sorry. These men are still shouting so loud at each other. I fear one of them may kill the other.
I can't hear them.
Well, I've shut my door, but I can hear them. There's like a truck parked in the street, and it's like, when are you going to move this truck or what else? I'm walking here. I'm driving here. I'm like, guys, I'm doing a podcast. Please, I'm going to be forced to make fun of you on the show if you don't stop.
Yeah, well, it's too late. The threat is reality.
The threat's real. I want to talk about, should we talk about what everybody else is talking about or not? About Sex and the City.
Yes. I sort of blacked it out of my brain, but here it is again.
Unfortunately,
and just like
it's,
that,
it's with us forever.
The terror reigns. Chaos reigns.
No, I'm really happy to be having like getting a woke moment from a bunch of older white rich ladies. I feel like it's really, they're the ones that should be offering up their opinions on the things that are happening
it's
in 2021. It makes sense.
So disturbing.
Mm.
But at the same
good
time,
word.
There is like some fun to watching it because you're like making fun of it afterwards. It's really fun.
It is. I wonder if that's why they did it. I wonder if they're like, you know what? We could make something that's like decent, or we could make something that's so awful that people just talk about it and it gives them joy and they laugh and laugh at us, which is what I think hopefully they're in on the joke.
Oh, I don't think they are. But who is in on the joke is Mr. Big and Peloton, because they made that commercial, which I found to be very clever.
I did too. Very good. Brava. Brava, Mr. Senor Big.
I don't think he actually had anything to do with it. He's just an actor. He was just paid. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I just, it was funny. Someone said it was like they're frozen in time. And I was like, exactly. Perhaps it's a reboot instead of Sex and the City. It could just be a modern day take on everyone's favorite movie, Encino Man.
Right, like they've been like frozen since the last episode of Sex and the City, and they just have awakened.
Exactly. Somebody kicked them into the East River. They froze into a block of ice in the winter, floated up to down to Antarctica, then floated back up, were unfrozen, and they're like, oh my God, COVID podcasts, what the fuck? Let's get
warming
into it. Global warming. Can't believe this ice block melted so quickly. We were supposed to stay in here for another 1,000 years.
And then we would never have had to see this show.
Oh my God. Breton, former co-host of this very podcast, we were chatting about it. He goes, I wonder what's going to happen in the end. Maybe they'll all die. Which I thought was so, so funny. The thought of them just, I know that's terrible, but like of them just all dying. Like,
it's not terrible. They all deserve to die. like so much sadness. Also, I can't believe that Callie from fucking Grey's Anatomy is playing this character on this television show. I just hate it for her so much. I love her.
Well, I'm hoping that Ben and Jen make an appearance. It would be the only thing that could give me any more possible joy.
Well, also, you said something really funny about how they have ruined Todd Rundgren for you because...
Absolutely. Ruined Todd Rundgren. That's such a great song. Hello? I mean, like, here's the thing. Like, why... Like I said to you earlier, is like, and I like Billy Joel, but take a Billy Joel song. Like, Todd Rundgren, that's not for you. Why do rich people have to take everything? Now I can never play Todd Rundgren in my apartment because my neighbors are going to think that I'm just like, oh, I heard this on Sex and the City and now I like it. And I think that's extremely fucked up. And I wonder what Todd Rundgren has to say about all this, honestly. Todd, call into the show.
Write or call in, Todd.
write us a song.
Why don't you write a reactionary song the way Peloton made a reactionary commercial?
I think that, like I was saying to you too, that they should have used Todd Rundgren's song Tiny Demon because that would have been much more appropriate. And it's like not one of my faves.
Also,
either they have to pick a hit.
I have a medical question.
Yeah,
that my friend asked me, which is, would he still be alive? Like, if he had like a major cardiac event like that, would he still be like sort of alive when Carrie got home? Is that true?
I'm not even sure that he had a cardiac event. Like we were talking about other day. I feel like he just got tired. He fell down. She accidentally drowned him in the shower. He was like, I'm just resting. I'm tired. I fucking rode. I'm old.
So
and then now she drowned him.
The rest of the season will be her trying to get away with murder.
Exactly. Now that would be a very interesting twist. Folks, if you're listening at home and you are witnessing someone having a cardiac event or really any kind of emergency, that's a good time to call 911.
Yeah.
That's the only time to call 911.
Yeah.
If there is a medical emergency, don't just hug them and squish them and drown them in the shower. Call
also,
an ambulance.
We should say that this episode contains spoilers.
Yes, if you don't want to know what happens in the first episode of Sex and the City, get yourself a time machine like your friend Brendan Fraser and go back to the Ice Age and then defrost in thousands of years. Yeah, this is a spoiler alert. Sorry. But yeah, I had to...
We previously just had some spoilers.
Sorry. We... In classic Life's a Banquet form, everything is after the fact. Ridiculous. I went to go see the lights in Diker Heights this weekend with my friends Jess and Trina. Mm-hmm. And it was so fun. And I bought a tiny little jar of rum with me because I had forgotten to get airplane bottles. So I brought a little jar of rum, which looked like urine. It was the only alcohol I had in my house. And then we saw the Christmas lights. We went to L&B's Pomone Gardens. And it was... it was a chef's kiss perfection.
I
want
to go
evening.
To Spumoni Gardens. I miss that.
Spumoni Gardens is great. And they're opening one in my neighborhood, kind of like down by Brooklyn Bridge Park. You know how there's like all the like pizza places down there? There's like Grimaldi, all like mediocre, like tourist pizza places. They're opening one down there. And I'm like, I'm not interested in it.
Well, you know what sucks about Spumoni Gardens?
Nothing.
They're Spumoni Italian ice.
You don't like the spumone? I like it. That shit's delicious.
I wanted
What's your
it to be
beef?
Ice cream. I thought it was ice cream.
Oh, no, it's like an ice.
I know.
Excuse us. I'm sorry. Just write them a letter. I mean, I like their spumone. I didn't get it the other day because it was absolutely freezing cold. I could barely even pry open my mouth to eat pizza, let
were
alone
you guys
spumone.
Sitting outside?
Yeah, we were sitting outside because they closed the inside. It's like not open in the pizza shop part anymore.
What?
Like, you can't go sit eat slices in the pizza shop part. You can go in the restaurant, like if you want to sit and have dinner. But I'm not sure that they serve pizza in the restaurant. So,
they
like,
don't.
We did not fuck with that. Yeah.
Or no, they do. Because I've eaten.
Do they?
I ate in the restaurant side one time, and I'm pretty sure that I don't remember. I'm pretty sure we got pizza.
All right. Well, look, if you're, if you know the answer to this question, please call into the show if anyone's even listening.
Yeah.
Mom?
Well, Mike Sala
just kidding.
Know,
she doesn't listen. Mike Sala, I meant to say, I have a huge regret. Mike Sala ordered from Zaza Lasagna this weekend. Famed lasagna pop-up from yours truly. Please order before we go bankrupt and out of business. I don't know why you guys are all back at restaurants and no one's ordering takeout. Just kidding. We're doing okay. But Mike Sala ordered a lasagna on Friday and it must have been like the 2 seconds I ran downstairs. He like came to pick it up and Mike, I didn't get to say hello to you and I feel terrible about it.
Oh, that's really fucked up.
I know. It's so silly. It's like the weirdest, rudest thing ever. I'm sorry.
Well,
I felt sad.
That's the trick. Speaking of rude things, I have some information about Ben Affleck.
I was hoping and praying that you would.
Okay. And his ex-wife is involved here too. Okay.
Who? Cruella DeVille?
No, her name is also Jennifer.
He's got a thing. He's got a Jennifer penchant.
Mm-hmm.
Watch out, Jennifer Coolidge.
Okay. Jennifer Garner was in high spirits at the farmer's market with her son after getting into a heated argument with Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck? What did he do? What were they fighting about?
I don't know. There's a picture of them standing on the street, and the radar online says, Jen Garner looks upset during intense conversation with ex-husband Ben Affleck, which is how I'm going to say
it. Ben Affleck is so funny, dude. Ben Affleck. Ben Affleck.
It's like Ben Affleck.
Say it three times he appears in the mirror and smokes a cigarette in your face.
And then, according to The Sun, there are seven secret signs that Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck will marry.
My God, what are they?
So, well, from a $1.2 million ring to a very spooky Mystic Meg prediction. I don't know who Mystic Meg is.
Oh, dude, Mystic Meg is the fucking shit, actually. Okay. Mystic Meg is like, she does horoscopes and they're so fucking awesome. She's one of, like, I love reading the Mystic Meg horoscopes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the number one prediction is the wedding dress. So at the AMAs, Jennifer Lopez wore a bridal gown, apparently.
Really? I'm going to look it up right now.
While she's saying, I mean, it does look pretty bridal, but also, I don't know. It is kind of a weird thing to be performing a concert in, but whatever. But the track On My Way is a single from her new rom-com, Marry Me.
Oh, wait, her new movie is called Marry Me? Yeah. Maybe this is all just like a, do you feel like maybe the whole thing is kind of just, like a publicity stunt?
Yes.
And they're not even really like together. They both have other boyfriends and girlfriends.
That could be possible. They also say that if they do want to tie the knot, the couple could have already sorted out their engagement ring because he proposed to her in 2002. So maybe he would just use the same $1.2 million ring that was pink.
He definitely should. She is wearing kind of a bridal gown. It's tan though, but it's nice.
Yeah, but she's also singing a song from her movie, Marry Me. So that is why she's wearing a wedding dress.
Right.
Okay, so Mary, again, 100%. J-Lo says she would, even though she's been married to 100 people, she would totally get married for a fourth time because she is a romantic. So if Ben was reading that, maybe he thought it was a message to him. the fourth sign that they're going to maybe secretly get married is the look of love. They can't seem to help but gaze adoringly into each other's eyes. So they are in a relationship is one of the signs, basically, is what they're saying.
Yes.
The fifth sign is family blending. The couple are reported to be planning a family Christmas with their two sets of kids. Maybe that's what Jennifer Garner was pissed about.
Yeah, she was like, now what am I supposed to do?
She was like, you can't take all my children and just give them to Jennifer Lopez.
There can't be two Jennifers in one Christmas celebration. Come on. Let's get serious here.
The sixth sign that they're going to get married is that they are red carpet ready, which means that they have been seen on the red carpet. And that, of course, means that a wedding will follow immediately after that.
I wonder if they'll walk down a red carpet for their wedding.
And the seventh sign is that it is written in the stars. Jennifer was born on July 24th and Affleck was born on August 15th. Oh, my God. They're both Leos. the star sign is ruled by the heart. I'm also a Leo. So this,
I know I was going to say,
this does track. I think that this
you're marrying them too.
I'm going to get married to them also.
You're a throuple.
So Leos are passionate and romantic and their competing egos make them butt heads, but they share the same values. So they're like lions known to crave physical touch. And with spooky accuracy, Mystic Meg predicted back in January that Leos could be in store for boomerang love in 2021.
Love boomerang love.
So all Leos, where's mine at?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Boomerang love, also.
When the old love comes back.
Oh, all right.
It looks like you and Gilbert Gottfried might get a second chance.
I hope so. You know, we did break up over that Aladdin incident.
You had that one in the chamber. That's because you're funny.
I did not have a fucking Gilbert Gottfried joke in the chamber. It just came to me. I was a comic genius.
Oh, that's funny. All right, cool. All right. Should we get into this week's topic?
Yeah, now let's talk about something that's not funny at all, because Zara is forcing us to talk about traditional Christmas foods, which is the most boring topic of all time, besides when we talked about World War II.
Well, actually, I have a World War of my story then.
World War One? Which war did we talk about?
We did a whole episode on World War II. But World War I is coming, folks. And
we're working.
Don't you worry.
We're doing all of our research. And
I know you've been dying, no pun intended, for our World War I follow-up.
And then we're also going to do the Hundred Years' War and the War of the Roses, the movie.
Well, I am covering a vintage war today in my story, so I'm not even kidding.
Okay, well, I also touch on a vintage war in my research.
You do? I hope it's not the same thing. What vintage war are you talking about?
The Crusades.
Oh, okay. That's a very vintage war. That's not the same
the
vintage
Crusades
war I'm talking about.
Starring Kevin Costner. Okay, so I'm talking to you today about two things, because I didn't have quite enough information about one thing. And okay. That is figgy pudding, and then we're just going to do a light dusting across mince pie.
Mmm, yummy.
Yes, delicious and brown.
Very brown.
So according to Wikipedia.com, figgy pudding is a vague term used for a class of traditional Christmas dishes, usually sweet or savory cakes, containing a sour, sweet, creamy layer of honey, fruits, and nuts. That to me is a very confusing way to describe this dish.
It's very, very confusing.
And then it says, and I'm quoting here, in later times, they started adding alcohol. So they're just like later on. We're not going to give you any sort of time frame. It could be like later on that day, later
just
on.
Later.
Just like later. Wikipedia
later
says,
alligator.
The height of our research in America is this Wikipedia article, and that's all they could come up with. later they started adding booze to it. The website Nitty Gritty Life says that the original figgy pudding was actually a pottage, which means it was meat, root, vegetables, and dried fruit stuffed into a sheep's stomach and boiled for many days.
Love it.
Which sounds is really yummy. And also, delicious. Is that what haggis is? Is that
kind
the same
of,
kind
yeah.
of thing?
Well, haggis is, yeah, it's similar. It's like rice and stuff. And I believe there's like nuts and yeah, it's a similar
it's
situation.
Some, yeah. So it probably is a pottage as well. So figgy pudding is often used interchangeably with plum pudding and Christmas pudding, but technically figgy pudding, the OG, is not the same. So, basically, the original figgy pudding was a wet, sticky, thick porridge made of boiled figs, wine, ground almonds, and raisins. And then it evolved into the steamed pudding that we think of as like Christmas pudding or plum pudding present day, if you're in England.
Interesting.
I, of course, have never eaten this before because I'm in America.
That's true. And you should stay in America because, you know, this pudding is dangerous, as we all know. And across the pond, they call everything pudding. That's a dessert, though, which
is
very confusing.
Very confusing, because what if you're eating, like, baklava, and that's pudding?
Absolutely. What about a cookie or ice cream? Also pudding? It just doesn't really make any sense, guys.
And then what happens when they get a pudding cup from Jell-O pudding?
That's exactly right, Nicole. What do you call that?
Chaos ensues, I'm sure. I don't even know if they're allowed to sell Jell-O pudding in England, but
I hope, yeah, probably not.
So basically the precursor was like this wadded up brown pile that eventually turned into a steamed pudding, which is basically like a steamed cake. And the reason why they were doing all this cake steaming is because they didn't have a lot of eggs, you know, it was hard to get some eggs.
Of course. Yeah.
So in 1845, This is the first year that people actually start calling this concoction a Christmas pudding. And it was in Eliza Acton's best-selling cookbook, Modern Cookery for Private Families, which I think is a very specific title.
For private families.
Like, what about the public families? Which only very private people need a cookbook. And it was a bestseller, so there must have been lots of private families around.
Incredible.
Christmas or plum pudding. It's called plum pudding in the UK because those crazy Victorians called anything that was a dried fruit a plum. So they're just like laying around on their fainting couches being like, that's a plum. That is a plum. Also, this is a plum. So the name stuck, but there are no plums in plum pudding.
There's interesting.
Just raisins. There's no figs in there either.
Wow, that's terrible. What a misnomer.
I know. Also, like a lot of Christmas dishes, according to this article, I did not really put this together, even though I was raised in the church, is that plum pudding is really incorporates baby Jesus symbolism into it. So it has 13 ingredients, one for Jesus and 12 for his apostles. You're supposed to put it out with a bunch of holly on top of it, and the holly is supposed to represent the crown of thorns. And then you set the pudding on fire because it's full of alcohol.
But why?
And the fire represents the passion of the Christ. And I don't know what the passion of the Christ is.
I don't either. I thought that Christ was meant to not have any passion. I mean, is Christ allowed to have sex?
Well, some people think that he did, but
some people think
he was just like a regular. He was just a regular Jesus walking around, but
regular Jesus.
There's also the movie The Passion of the Christ, which I have not seen, but maybe it would tell me what the passion of the Christ is. But I can't watch it because of Mel Gibson.
Yeah, you're not a Mel Gibson fan. I wish Mel Brooks had done it instead. That would have been a better.
Well,
film.
He kind of, didn't he do a movie like that?
Yeah, Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Jesus, also, Dead and Loving It.
Speaking of Dead and Loving It, traditionally, Christmas pudding is made 5 weeks before Christmas. And you just put it in the basement. So basically, really? So basically it's kind of like a fruitcake. So like you basically, there's nuts. You're preserving it with all the alcohol, and then it will keep for almost forever. So you can just like, as long as you wrap it up and put it in the basement, it'll be fine in 5 weeks. And also the 5 weeks aging or whatever brings out more of the flavors, allegedly. I don't know. But we did a whole episode.
I'm happy to try this.
We had a whole episode about fruitcakes. You guys should go back and revisit because that was funny, I think.
It was very funny. I re-listened to it recently. Your detailing of fruitcake is amazing.
And also there's like a fruitcake throwing contest.
And I talk about gingerbread, which I think is also quite hilarious. if you like those sweet and kind of, you know, spiced delight, Christmas delights, this episode's for you.
One more thing about fucking figgy pudding. The Victorians, these nutty, nutty Victorians, because they didn't have TV.
The Figtorians?
Nope. They, there was a tradition, so they would set the figgy pudding on fire, the Christmas pudding, forgive me. And then the kids around the table would go and try to pick the fruit out of the burning, hot, flaming pudding.
Guys, come on.
Like, that was what the children would do. They were like, kids, get over here. Put your hands in this fire and see if you can fish out some flaming hot plums that are actually raisins.
The original Flaming Hot Cheetos was just Flaming Hot Raisins.
Oh, my God. That reminds me of something. We do need to talk about this. So there's, like, now Flaming Hot Cheetos flavored items at Applebee's, like wings.
Oh. Okay.
No.
Go on.
Wrong.
It doesn't make sense to me because it's just like, it's too much like back and forth, right? Like the Flaming Hot Cheeto is already the flavor of a wing, right?
Right.
Because like a wing is a spicy whatever.
Wow, I didn't even think about this, but you're right.
Right. So it's like this weird overlapping, like never ending fucking life cycle. It's like an Ouroboro, like a snake eating its tail. Like when does it stop? Are then they going to make like Flaming Hot Cheeto dusted wing flavored Flaming Hot Cheetos, and then they make Flaming Hot Cheeto flavored wing dusted Flaming Hot Cheeto flavored wings. It's like, who's going to put a stop to this? At some point, it's just going to become too much.
I mean, Biden isn't doing anything about this. And
that's true. Well, he's dead. That's why.
Oh, he's dead and loving it. That's right.
He's dead and loving it. <That's> so funny. He can't do anything. He's dead. He's busy dead and loving it.
Yeah, he's very busy loving it, being dead. Okay, well, I'm sorry that I digressed into Flaming Hot Cheetos, but someone had to say something. But I'm done talking about figgy pudding now, and I'm going to talk to you about mince pie, which is what everyone has been asking us to talk about for years. Years and years.
After you do that World War I episode, please, on to mince pies.
Yeah, so mince pie is a sweet pie of an English origin with dried fruits and spices that is called mincemeat. The pie dates back to the 13th century when Crusaders, ACAB...
all Crusaders are bad.
Are bastards. And that is correct, Zara. Crusades are really fucked up. So even though Kevin Costner is very handsome, it's fucked up that he fought in the Crusades when he played Robin Hood.
It is. Ryan and his girlfriend, Corey, recently bought me a pack of Robin Hood, I wanted to say Men in Tights, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves trading cards.
Well, that sounds delightful. But I feel like I hope no money went to the Crusades for the purchase of those cards.
That's true. Well, you know, it's like if you support like someone after they passed away, like, you know, it's not like you're directly giving them money. So I think at this point the Crusades are long enough past that no one's getting rich off them.
Well, you don't know that, Zara.
Except for the Catholic Church, yeah.
The Catholic Church. So when they went on their fucking psychotic religious war, they killed a bunch of people and stole their recipes and brought them back to England. So this is also sort of referring to the gift of the Magi, which is cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg. So basically they found a lot of Middle Eastern food. They're like, this is yummy. I wish that dead person could tell me this real recipe. I'm just going to make it up on my own. So they became these pies, and there's a lot of Christian symbolism packed into these pies, obviously, because these people have a one-track mind.
There's Christian symbolism packed into every bite.
These people cannot get enough of baby fucking Jesus. They are obsessed with the Christ child. I don't know what their deal is. The pies themselves back in the day were shaped like the manger that little baby Jesus.
Oh, wow. That's a lot. That's very complicated, it seems. Yeah. A manger shaped pie?
Well, it's more like a coffin shape, but they called it the manger.
Okay, got it.
It's interesting symbolism there. But early versions were also called a mutton pie, a shrid pie, which is my favorite version.
A shrid pie?
Yeah.
That's like a great insult.
You're a shrid pie.
Shove it, shrid pie. That's probably what the guy outside was saying to the other guy.
Yeah.
You're a fucking shrid pie.
Yeah, he sounds like he's definitely from the time of the Crusades. And then eventually this pie became associated with Catholic idolatry. So during the English Civil War, which I didn't even know that they had an English Civil War. We were just copying off them when we had our Civil War.
Yeah, basically. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you. Even war. Even war?
No, okay. Why do you sing on every episode now? You're not.
I'm singing on the podcast.
Wow. I have to go. During the English Civil War, which was probably, you know, more fun than our Civil War, the Puritans were like, Catholics suck. All of this idol worship and all of this fucking mince pie is wrong. And we as Puritans will not participate in it. And Puritan church leaders were not allowed to eat mince pie at Christmas, which sounds very sad to me. But the Puritans notoriously are really boring losers. And that's, you know, our founding fathers or whatever. So
totally. Can you imagine that's how you want to spend your one life as a motherfucking Puritan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, that's all I have for you guys.
No, it's very interesting. I want to just tack on something to this, Nicole. I don't know if you're familiar with Fanny Craddock. Have you ever heard of her?
Was she like one of the Salem witches?
No, but kind of. She was a woman in like the 60s or maybe even a little bit before. I can't remember. Bretton did a whole episode about her.
Oh, she's like the marijuana lady.
No, she is, try again. She was like the original Julia Child. So she had like a cooking show on TV, but she dressed so crazy. She looked like she was dressed as like a drag queen, essentially. Her makeup, big eyebrow, and she was British. And she like, oh my God, she looked incredible. So fabulous. So wild. And she had there was like no running water yet for like cooking sets. So she'd like have her hands in these mince pies and then she would just like wipe them off with like a dry towel. Ah! It's just really funny. You have to watch it. Truly. Anyone listening, go ahead and do a quick YouTube rabbit hole of Fanny Craddock and you will thank me later.
Okay. Also,
she has one when she makes mince pies particularly. That's quite great.
Okay. Also, who's the marijuana lady then?
That was maybe also a Fanny. I did the story of her. I don't know. I can't remember.
Whatever. I'll look it up. Go back and listen to pre-me episodes if you want to. Or you could also just do a Wikipedia article.
Yep. Quick wiki search and there you go. Mary something. I don't remember. Okay. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So just a quick, we looked over on the break, her name was Mary Jane Rathburn. And she was awesome because she started baking brownies for a lot of people who were, suffering from and dying from AIDS.
Her name was Mary Jane?
Yeah. Mary Jane Rathburn. Mm-hmm. I know. Isn't it wild?
It is.
Brownie wild. Mary, they called her. Brownie Mary. Go back and listen to that episode with Brownie Mary. That's a good one. Okay. So for today, folks, I am doing a story that I have already done. Why is this? Because I did it in one of our very first episodes. I feel like A, perhaps many of you hadn't listened to it, and B, maybe I didn't do such a great job of telling it. So I wanted to retell it. Maybe yes. So I wanted to retell it because it's one of the greatest stories that I've ever heard about Christmas food. And it is the story of basically when in 1870, the elites of Paris ate the entire zoo.
What?
Yes. So I got my information today mostly from two articles. One great article in Munchies called When They Ate the Zoo, Nobody Wanted to Touch the Hippo by Casper Foe Hansen and Lars Eriksson, and an article in Atlas Obscura by Anne Eubank. So basically, I'm going to start off by telling you a little bit about your favorite war and mine, the Franco-Prussian War.
I love that war.
I love it too. It was so adorable. So often referred to in France as the War of 1870, it was a conflict between the Second French Empire and the North German Confederation, led by the Kingdom of Prussia. Now, totally. Prussia is also Germany. Not to be confused with the King of Prussia Mall, which I think is somewhere in Philadelphia. Your favorite mall. So it lasted from July 19th, 1870 to January 29th, 1871. So not a terribly long war, just a little quickie war.
Just like we're mad.
we're angry. And it was a conflict caused by France's determination to restore its dominant position in continental Europe, which had lost following Prussia's crushing victory over Austria in 1866, as you all know. I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm just telling you stuff you already know, obviously. According to historians, Prussia's chancellor, Otto von Bismarck, deliberately provoked the French into declaring war on Prussia in order to draw four independent southern German states to join the North German Confederation.
Wise.
So that's just a little backstory. Mm-hmm. So during the siege of Paris in the year 1870, when like this all kind of circled around Paris, the German Emperor Kaiser Wilhelm had crushed the French forces at Sedan, making mincemeat of Napoleon and his unmotivated troops.
Mincemeat, so, full circle.
Exactly. So one of the things about the Franco-Prussian War that people actually might remember is that they were, like, all of the Prussians were wearing spiked helmets.
Ah, yes.
It's a very famous look. I wish we would bring it back today.
I do, yeah. All I remember about wars is the fashion.
Yes, the fabulous fashion. So Paris was surrounded, and the remains of France were going to be starved into submission, and there was a severe shortage of food in the city. So they hadn't surrendered yet, but they, like, had the city surrounded, so they couldn't get any food in or out. In the months that followed, the September, Parisians ate 70,000 horses.
Oh, no. 70,000 horses were living there?
Exactly. I'm very confused. All the dogs, all the cats, and all of the rats that they could find. And, like, what would happen with that, like, towards the middle of this thing, like, in the late fall, but when they had eaten all the horses, then they went to cats and dogs and rats, and, like, butcher shops would have cats and dogs and rats on display. You'd go to bistros, they'd be selling prefix menus with rat, mice, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so we are facing, like, a cataclysmic food shortage, and yes, restaurants are still open.
Exactly.
No, that seems insane.
Because it is the Parisian way. Okay. You know?
They're like, we simply must go out to eat.
Many restaurants closed, but it wasn't. Yeah, exactly. We have to go out to eat, even if the only thing on the menu is like a fricassee of, you know, tiny house door mice.
Huh. Okay.
So in the days leading up to Christmas, the zoo in Paris announces that it can no longer feed the animals and they would have to all be put down because they, you know, there's no food. Why are we going to feed the animals?
They tell the nation this?
Yes. So instead,
good. Everyone was so much more honest in the 1800s.
Right? Instead of killing them, they decided that they're going to eat them.
Well, they would still have to kill them.
Well, instead of just killing them and, like, burning them in a fire, they were like, let's eat these fuckers. And so there's a couple of things they didn't eat. Like, they didn't eat the monkeys. They didn't eat the lions and tigers, which I'm unclear on why not. And the hippo is apparently too disgusting to eat. Which,
what? That's so mean. I know. Hippo. Also, why wouldn't they eat a lion? I feel like that would be, like, a lot of meat.
Absolutely. And then you could wear the fabulous fur.
Oh, my God.
I don't get it. Oh, do you know that the costume in The Wizard of Oz, the lion costume, is actually real, like, a real lion hide?
Whoa.
And it weighed, like, 100 pounds. That poor man had to go.
That poor lion.
And the poor lion. Everyone, it was a lose-lose situation. But, okay, so there's a famous chef. His name was Chef Alexandre Etienne Charron, and he was famous for a sauce called Charron sauce. And Charron sauce is essentially a Bernaise that doesn't have chervil or tarragon and that is flavored with tomato puree.
Huh, okay. Sounds
so
good.
Yeah, he gets put in charge of making his version of, like, the Last Supper. Again, Jesus, hello. So Voisin restaurant was his restaurant. It was on the Rue Saint-Honoré, and it was the distinguished where distinguished Parisians went to feel even more distinguished. The restaurant is a part of a genetic ancestry of haute cuisine, and one of the seven pillars of culinary wisdom.
Oh, I knew that was one of the seven pillars of culinary wisdom.
Of course. What are the others? Flaming Hot Cheetos.
Yeah, Applebee's, Chili's.
Crystal Clear, Amoco, Ultimate, Pepsi. Okay, so it was a civilized city's only approach to taunting back at the cannon and steel and Bismarck. So it was almost like part of the reason they were doing this is be like, you can't, you know, decimate us at all. Even if you try, we're just going to make whatever we have fabulous.
Okay, but like, how would the freaking Prussians even know that they were doing this? Like, this
I
is
know,
the 1800s. I'm like, did you send them like a photograph, like a lithograph?
They sent them how to make a painting of it and then bring it down the hill.
Send them a painting, and then the painting's going to take a long time to make.
I know, it's very confusing.
Okay.
So there was an American doctor who was in Europe at the time, and he had the bad luck of being trapped in Paris during the siege. Dr. Robert Lowry Sibet hailed from Pennsylvania and collected his recollections of the siege in a 580-page volume, The Siege of Paris by an American Eyewitness, published 1892.
All right.
He goes on to say the first sign that that all was not well was on October 10th, when in order to stem the number of sheep and cattle killed each day, the city opened its markets to horse meat. Nothing was wasted. The horse in arbitrator was blindfolded, struck with a sledgehammer on the forehead, and bled out with a large knife. The blood was caught in basins and used for purposes of making puddings.
Yucky.
On November 12, 1870, a stall was erected on the Rue Rochart. On the side of the stall was several large dogs, neatly dressed. Next to these, several large cats, also neatly dressed, which I know means like that they've been butchered. Like,
yes.
But it sounds like they're dressed in like nice outfits.
They're literally wearing little cute outfits covered in their own blood.
On the left is a dozen or more rats stretched upon a tray, and a young woman, half veiled, timidly approached them with a little girl by her side. She wishes to inquire of the price of rats, and she has enough money to purchase one. So then people go on to say dog is not a bad substitute for mutton, and cat, as all of the world knows, is often eaten for rabbit. The rich, on the other hand, made merry over the pâtés de rat. Rat turned out to be very pricey. Sibet recorded the cat and dog meat was anywhere between 20 and 40 cents per pound, but the plump rat cost 50 cents per pound.
Why? There's so many more rats than cats and dogs.
I know, and this is just proof you can convince rich people to jump on literally any bandwagon, including preferring rat meat.
Also, I feel like the plague wasn't that long ago. They just forgot about rats being like sort of plague filled.
I know.
I guess if you cook them, it's fine. I don't know.
I guess. So anyway, back to Chef Charron and the Christmas Day menu of 1870 at Voisin Restaurant. On the menus is emblazoned with the words 99th day of the siege. So for the Christmas dinner on December 25th, 1870, and this menu was like, the menu was, the chef has a daily changing menu between December 25th and January 1st. It was a week long kind of extravagant event. He orchestrated one of history's most famous menus, which makes even today's avant-garde chefs look like wimpy in their efforts.
Wimpy?
To champion muskox, buffalo, or insects.
Hmm. So, where did they get buffalo from?
No, they didn't have buffalo. The person who wrote this article was saying it makes...
I see.
Yeah, people who try to like cook buffalo and insects today look silly. So Charron had gotten the meat from the Paris Zoo, including the only elephants at the zoo named Castor and Pollux.
Aww.
The two had been named after twin sons of Zeus who allegedly helped the infant Roman city-state defeat their Etruscan rivals back in the day. The elephants suffered a fate and did not suit their heroic names. So
how do they get all that heavy elephant meat around?
I don't know. It's a great question. And like, who cut up an elephant? Like, were these butchers even qualified to cut up elephants? How did they keep it cold, actually, is my biggest question here.
That is a good question. But it was January.
It was cold. It was January and it was before global warming. So they were lucky. It was probably cold outside already.
Yeah.
Great point.
Yeah.
So for starters, he serves a donkey head with sardines.
Okay. There was a donkey at the zoo?
Yeah. I mean, what a, like, how rude, like, to go, you have like elephants, lions and tigers and like, a donkey. I mean, it just seems like a little bit of a letdown. The author goes on to say, one can only imagine the donkey head with its hair pulled off by a red hot iron, baked slowly, glazed like a boar's head with pins to hold up the ear, prunes for eyes, teeth inside congealed fat, all mounted on a bread plinth, a complete mockery of a classic banquet centerpiece.
Okay.
Not sure why they put sardines in it. Doesn't seem like it would be a great pairing, but who am I? I'm certainly no seventh pillar of the world, culinary world.
No,
I'm just a lowly lasagna baker. I would have made some kind of elephant lasagna, obviously. Mm-hmm. It would have, so they carved it and it was polished by, it had silver that was polished by waiters. They had expensive wine. It was crazy. Next, there was elephant consomme, which was a heavy clarified stock.
Okay, because the elephant was heavy.
I guess the rich, fatty elephant stock sounds kind of good. Over the following days, Chef Charron added to his reputation by serving the elephant's trunk with sauce chaussure, which is hunter's sauce, and even teased diners with a special version of beef bourguignon, which was made with elephant instead of beef.
Okay, I have a question here.
Please.
A couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, is it ethical to charge money for the only food left inside of wherever they were?
In Paris, yeah.
Because it seems like, you know, this elephant could probably feed like a lot of people.
Like, I know.
Hundreds of people for free, but we're doing this restaurant thing.
Capitalism, baby. The rich. Then,
I don't really understand what a siege is, because in my mind, if something is being sieged, like people
wouldn't
are
they
like
just take it?
Running towards it with sharp knives.
Exactly. And I don't understand why they just start. It was like cruel and unusual punishment, just starving them out like this.
So it's not really a siege. Can also be where you just sit down and wait for them to starve to death.
I guess so. I mean, or you can be under siege on like a boat, a submarine, like
right.
Tommy Lee Jones. Well, I feel like Steven Seagal.
And under siege, there's definitely sharp objects.
Yeah, of course, Tommy Lee Jones gets, as we all know, gets famously stabbed in the forehead. Ouchie. Yes,
he sure does. And he does not survive.
Nope. Okay, so next on the Christmas menu, there was fried camel a l'anglaise, kangaroo stew, bear shanks, and pepper sauce. One of the oddest pairing was a dish that was called, in English, it would be translated to cat flanked by rats.
Okay.
So it was an entire cat with like rats around
bone
it.
Bone in
cat. So the chef recommends today, we have a lovely cat flanked by rats. So this is going to be bone in. So it's not for the squeamish.
No.
The rat tails are on. They're fried crispy. You can chomp away at them.
Nope.
So then there was an antelope and truffle sauce with the horns still on. There was all kinds of wacky stuff. So also during the Christmas 1870 dinner, the Paris elite rated, and all the elite restaurateurs, all of the fucking bourgeoisie, rated their wine cellars for the most precious bottles. Charron's wine pairing for his famous meal was Mouton Rothschild, 1846, Romanée Conti, 1958, Chateau Palmier, 1864, were all part of the selection.
1958?
The greatest wines. No, 1858. The greatest from the future wine. The greatest wines from the greatest vintages stored to their climax with infinite patience. So
well,
they drank
not
all this like crazy
patience,
expensive.
This is not,
right.
This is finite.
That's true.
But I guess maybe they thought they were going to die, so it's fine to get the old wine out.
I guess so. I mean, I think they were just really living it up.
Sure.
But part of me respects this and thinks it's cool, like, to make the most of, like, a shitty situation and kind of just, I like that mentality. The other part of me agrees with you. It's just, like, isn't it just, like, the bourgeoisie to, like, drink expensive wine and eat all the elephant meat while others probably starve to death?
Yeah.
Share that elephant meat, you fuckers.
Yeah, man.
So shortly after, in the early days of January, 72 Krupp cannons were unleashed over the city of Paris. It was bombed to the point of surrender in a blaze of shrapnel, which destroyed more of the city than any other war has subsequently achieved, including your other favorite war, World War II.
That's wild.
So that's kind of how it ended. They just surrendered, which I'm not sure why it took them so long. They had to, like, it had to come to eating all of the zoo meat before they did, but... Yeah.
So they ate the whole zoo and then they were like, okay, so that's probably why they're drinking the fancy wine, because they had to surrender the city and they were afraid
right.
that the Prussians are going to come in and drink all of their wine.
Exactly. The Prussians are coming.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is very interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's very, I think it's a very interesting story. It has like, again, like I appreciate the fact that they lived it up, but also share the elephant meat.
Isn't there another similar situation where they just killed all the zoo animals? I feel like there's some other scenario where this, but maybe I'm just conflating the story with we bought a zoo.
You think there's you remember another story where they ate the zoo? I think this is it, baby.
No, I don't think they ate the zoo. I think they just killed all the animals.
Oh, I'm sure that's happened many times. It seems like a real fuck you to come into someone's city and kill their animals.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's happened before.
Yeah. But maybe they were also like, we're protesting zoos, you know?
Sure. Like, zoos are very strange.
Yes, it is mean to kill this giraffe, but also this giraffe should never have been living in Paris.
Exactly. So what are your top three favorite Christmas foods? Not including elephant soup.
My top three favorite Christmas foods are probably, this is hard because we don't really have the same thing every year, but I do love making sugar cookies with frosting.
I know you do, and I think that's adorable.
Really fun, really tasty treat. I like a simple little sugar cookie, very simple, nothing complicated. I also really like macaroni and cheese. We just have macaroni and cheese and ham usually, which I don't like ham.
I thought you said in hand.
In hand.
Like you put it in your hand.
As soon as you walk in the door at my parents' house at Christmas, they put macaroni and cheese directly into your palm. All the like Christmas candy stuff I just don't normally eat is fun to eat. Like I just saw a candy cane filled with Reese's cups at the store yesterday and I'm like, oh yeah, that's delicious.
Oh yeah. Absolutely amazing. I like the Reese's bells, like the bell-shaped Reese's.
Oh, yeah. Are those even still around?
Mm-hmm. I just saw them at CVS the other day.
Okay. Yeah, CVS really gets all the varieties in there.
They do. Okay. Is that it for you? Yeah,
that was three.
Okay. So I really love Christmas cookies, like different kinds of Christmas cookies. Mm-hmm. And the ones I like to make the most, the ones I most appreciate when someone gifts to me are those little Mexican wedding cookies. They also call them like Russian tea cakes sometimes. They're like basically just ground nuts, and all kinds of yummy spices and then dusted and powdered sugar. I really like, because my family is part Italian, normally we go to Bomonti's and we always have some variation. We don't, like, when we go to Bomonti's on Christmas Eve, we don't do, like, the seven fishes or whatever necessarily, but that's, like, red sauce and fish, like, having, like, shrimp marinara or mussels marinara, calamari, for, like, that feels very traditional for me in my family. And I guess I also really love, if I have to be honest, and I know this is probably we're going to lose some listeners because of this. I like eggnog.
Oh, I love eggnog.
I like eggnog. It is basically just drinking heavy cream with eggs in it. Mm-hmm. It's like drinking melted ice cream.
Yeah.
But I find it to be delicious.
It's very delicious. I also just bought some like vegan eggnog because it's a little bit less heavy.
Vegan nog. Okay. Oat milk?
It's almond milk.
Almond nog.
It's really delicious in coffee also. Just pouring some eggnog.
That's a great point, isn't it?
Coffee. Yeah. But that reminded me of something that I forgot about, which I also love Christmas food-wise, is Chex Mix.
Chex Mix is great, yes.
My stepmom makes a really good version with lots of Worcestershire. So some of the pieces are still chewy, which I really enjoy. But typically...
Oh, that's smart.
This is going to definitely make us lose some listeners. When I eat Chex Mix, I only eat the Rice Chex out of there. I don't eat anything else.
Oh, really? How inconsiderate of you.
I'm a huge bitch. But yeah, I also had some Chex Mix over Thanksgiving, and I ate only the Rice Chex out of there. And then eventually there was no more Rice Chex, so I had to switch to Wheat Chex, which is, a cruel disappointment.
I'm sorry, my friend. All right, guys. Well, this has been a riveting episode. I feel like I learned a lot. I laughed. I cried. Mm-hmm. I had a ball. And now I'm off to fix myself a little bowl of elephant broth before I go to work.
All right. That sounds great.
All right, folks. Love you very much. Hasta la pasta.
Bye.
Bye.
Life's Banquet is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.